Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Gretel Ehrlich is one of the preeminent and most admired observers of the natural world. She's written numerous books, and her shorter work has been widely published in periodicals and anthologies. A former correspondent for NPR's Day to Day, Gretel has reported from around the globe. She wrote and recorded a poem cycle in collaboration with the Siobhan Davies Dance Company in London and was a founding member of the UK's Cape Farewell Artists and Climate Change Project. She is the recipient of many honors, including the Penn Thoreau Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, a Whiting Award, and the Harold Vercel Award for Distinguished Prose from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. We're delighted that Gretel Ehrlich has returned to the Tattered Cover tonight to present her heartbreaking yet inspirational portrait of Japan after the 2011 tsunami, Facing the Wave. Would you please join me now in making Gretel Ehrlich feel welcome?
Thank you very much. I just want to thank the Tattered Cover, which is one of the great, great, great independent bookstores in this country. There's so few left, and we're just indebted to these places for saying yes to literature, serious books. So I'm really grateful to be here. I went to Japan a couple of months after the tsunami happened in March 2011. Japan experienced three disasters simultaneously: the 9.03 earthquake, the tsunami that had run-up heights of between 60 and 133 feet, and, of course, the meltdown, the four meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. So some of the people said, well, we live in this, on this seismically wild island. We're used to earthquakes. Many of us have experienced tsunamis. Many people have lost houses. We're always expecting that to happen, but we weren't expecting to be radiated in the process. So, you know, it was sort of like, we can heal from this, but how does one heal from that, especially given what happened to them in World War II? I met one woman who's lost a house in Nagasaki and then lost another house in the tsunami. She was actually laughing. She said, what are the odds of that happening? How many are there of us old enough still, you know, in Japan that that could have happened? But the great 17th century poet Matsuo Basho said, the person in mourning is a slave to sorrow. I met no one in Japan who was a slave to sorrow. Matsuo Basho was really important to me in this trip because the great long tradition in Japanese literature of what they call travel diaries, which Niki no Michi, the fifth of which is called Oku no Hosomichi, very famous, which actually took Basho up to the area where the tsunami hit. So I felt often that I was sort of part of that tribe of the mountains and rivers, walking, bum, shack-dwelling writer, poet, painter, half-ass Buddhist practitioner, etc. And so I felt... what's always interesting about that is that you're not doing something new and brave. You're just adding another layer to what's already been done many times before, and probably better. And but it was a sort of embrace to find myself often on Basho's trail. I had no agenda. I just knew I had to go to Japan, where I had been many times, and felt a great inexplicable affinity, which I felt all my life, to go there. So I went. And so off I went, and, you know, everybody faced the wave in that 375-mile coast that was erased by, first shattered by the earthquake and then erased by water. Some people made it and some people didn't. That part of Japan, northeastern Honshu, is very rural, very un-Tokyo-like. They're either rice farmers or fishermen, and a few little country Buddhist temples. It's very beautiful. The coastline is just like Highway 1 in Big Sur. But in each cove is a little village, a little fishing village, and then maybe a bigger town and with a harbor. And it's just really, it was lovely. It's still lovely. And then big mountains behind, covered with cedar trees. It's just a really elegant place. So I'm going to start off with one of the fishermen who made it but lost a lot in the process. Mizu no Michi, the path of water, how one swims in it and what it teaches along the way. A wave rises from a seismic rip in the seafloor. It spreads out low and travels at jet speed, mounding up as it hits shore. Kikuchi-san was driving when his car was almost shaken off the road. 6 minutes later, he turned towards his parents' house to rescue them, knowing that a tsunami would come, but his father was going the other way, bicycling toward the harbor. "Don't go there!" Kikuchi-san yelled out, but the elderly man didn't hear. By the time he caught up with him, his father had climbed the seawall and was clutching a steel ladder facing the sea. Kikuchi-san remembers a roar. Water was receding, surging backwards until the ocean floor lay exposed. "We've got to get out of here," he yelled, but his father didn't move. The roar intensified. A white line appeared at the horizon. The wave was coming fast. As Kikuchi-san climbed up to get to his father, water came at him. His father shook his head, refusing to budge. One last look, then the young fisherman jumped off the wall. When he turned back, his father was gone. My father chose to stay, and in that second, I accepted it and thought it would be the same for me too. Water towered over him. He saw a 9-ton squid boat teetering on the wave's crest, its glass attractor lamp swinging and shattering. The wave swept him into the river that splits the town of Kamaishi in half. He climbed onto a metal roof, but the water caught him there too, sucking him backwards, pulling him out to sea. The water roiled. It was black with diesel and gas, sewage, dirt, and blood. And Kikuchi-san rolled and thrashed inside its debris-marbled night. The collapsed wave took the fishermen all over the place. Heavy house beams and pieces of boats slammed into him. He grabbed a breath, went down, shot up again. Another wave drove him deeper, then tossed him sideways and up. He remembered seeing two concrete pillars zoom by as he was pulled under a bridge. His head broke water. He could breathe. A piece of plastic buoy appeared and he grabbed it. "Retreating water took me back out," he said, "and another wave carried me in again." Dead bodies were floating, parts of houses catapulted, cars tumbled, a floating roof banged into a bridge and flipped on its side. The present was splintered. He was lost in a lost world. There was a roar. He looked. Another wave was coming back. Water covered him, and he was driven toward one of the bridge pillars. He saw a rope dangling. I barely got to the pillar before the ocean began dragging me back, so I reached for it and grabbed it. My lower half was submerged. Debris was being pulled out, but I kept holding on. As the water drew away, my legs were pulled out in front of me. I was holding tight, floating on my back with my head up. At first, I wasn't worried about losing my grip, but then my hands got cold. Water came in false tidal sequences. Between waves, he remembers another period of stillness. The sea was a lagoon, he said. A log floated past. I climbed onto it. Sitting astride the dead tree, he could see the extent of the destruction for the first time. The entire port had been demolished. Fishing boats had been hurled onto the tops of buildings. He lost his boat. Almost every house was gone, including his own. A beam floated by. He was swimming in the remnants of his past. Another fisherman I met, a father and a son team, had a different experience. They got to their boat in time and faced the wave. A 50-foot trawler slides up to the loading dock, manned by a father-son team, its entire aft deck stacked with plastic baskets of giant Pacific octopus, throbbing and writhing, confined and confused. When the quake came, he said, I knew there would be a tsunami, so I drove to the harbor, got on my boat, pulled anchor, and started out. My boat's about 50 feet long. Suddenly, it lifted up into the air. It was the wave coming in. It felt as if we were being lifted up from beneath. We were 80 meters up above the bottom of the ocean and stayed there for about 3 minutes. The water was rough and confused, moving every which way. It was hard to steer. I kept going. Another 10 minutes out, I thought I'd be safe. There's a little island out there. I thought it would be far enough. Then I saw the horizon was all white again. This was the big wave coming. It came in fast and submerged the island's lighthouse. It came under my boat and lifted it 120 meters above the ocean bottom. And still I could see more waves coming. I turned and looked. Waves were crashing over the seawall, through the harbor, pouring through town. I stayed out for 2 days. I was afraid to come back in. There were about 10 boats out there. No one had any warm clothes, much less food or water. I was cold and hungry. The water was moving in strange ways and was covered with debris. My house was at the foot of the mountain. I looked with binoculars, trying to find it. Only the roof was left. I saw the house poles being carried away by small waves. I couldn't call my wife. Our cell phones didn't work. There was no reception. But another fisherman came alongside and told me the entire coast had been destroyed. So that's what it was like for fishermen. They're coming back and they're starting to fish again. So I started off in June. I spent 3 months in Japan. I went in June when there was really an experience of survivor's euphoria. I mean, they had sort of gotten past the shock of what had happened to them. I mean, many people lost loved ones. You know, I met fathers who lost children and mothers and fathers and grandparents. I lost, you know, and there were people who had lost all of their means of living. I mean, the rice fields were covered in 3 or 4 feet of muck from the ocean and debris and dead bodies and things. And fishermen had lost their boats, so plus their houses, their cars, their bicycles, everything. So people were in a... they were still living in evacuation places, you know, gymnasiums of schools and all chock-a-block. But, you know, living quite well together. It was very well organized. They were taken care of well. And then, meanwhile, the Japanese government was building temporary housing for them, these tiny little spaces. But, you know, they had a television and a proper kitchen and a tiny shower. And, you know, they had all the basic necessities, and that's where they're all living now. But in June, they were just those who had survived despite the deep kinds of grief. There was also this euphoria, just absolute astonishment that they were alive. And everywhere I went, people, especially the women, would come running out to greet us and you know, invite us in for tea or whatever and tell us their stories. And very welcoming and very open. It was this kind of openness that, you know, when there's nothing to lose, there's nothing to lose. And so all the conventional behaviors just fall away. It was amazing. So the first, I had two sets of translators. The first woman lived with her parents, and I moved in with them. There was no place to stay. And so I became part of their family, and they were farmed rice out on the Sendai Plain. And all of her uncles and great uncles had lost everything, houses, farms, tractors, everything. And they were just trying to replant food to eat in the winter. I mean, when you have no means of making a living, you have no money and you have no way to eat. So it was really back to survival time. And then there was, so, you know, Masumi came from a really pleasant sort of middle-class Japanese family. Her parents sort of took me in like one of their children, even though I was older than all of them. But they were just wonderful. And then it was time for me to go farther north, and I had a young woman, a 26-year-old woman, half New Zealander, half Japanese, and a driver. And this was where things, well, you know that when you're writing a book and things start to sort of make sense in an odd way, that you're on the right track. Her name was Nikki. In Japanese, Nikki means diary. Nikki no Michi is diary of the road. Michi means road or path or Buddhist path. And the driver who we got just at the last moment by chance was nicknamed Abyss. I thought, this is really good. The path of the, or the diary of the abyss, that's what we're engaged in here. And they were just wonderful. He arrived at the Sendai train station in a really battered up old Toyota van with a plywood panel, piece of wood in the back for a bed. And, you know, it was just a hippie van. It was just great. And I sat in the front seat with him, and Nikki was on the bed in the back, and we trundled around. We had no agenda particularly, but it made it really fantastic. And so I'll read a little of that. We're on the road again, and Abe-san plays that song. I roll down the window. What I thought would be fresh air is instead full of the stink of decadent refuse. Nikki sits cross-legged on the plywood platform and back, translating when she has to, checking emails and tweets when she doesn't. Down from the mountains, we come to the town of Kamaishi. Our way is blocked by a ship that has come on shore. The Asia Symphony is not a musical group, but a 4,000-ton cargo ship pushed by the wave into the middle of what was once a busy street. High on a hill, a huge white statue of cannon looks down on Kamaishi's ruined harbor. "What does the goddess of compassion think now?" I asked Abe-san. He smiles. She says she has a lot of work to do. "We're looking for an 84-year-old geisha whose life was saved by a sake merchant who hoisted her on his back and ran to safety. She's been dubbed the last geisha of Kamaishi, and we find her in an evacuation center, once the gym of the junior high. Her dancing name was Chikano Fujima, though she's also known as Ito-san. Still a beauty with high cheekbones, gray hair pulled back tight, and sparkling dark eyes, she's the last holder of an ancient song, an uta called Hama Uta, or the Kamaishi Bay Fisherman's Song. People wanted to hear it again, she told me, and I'm not going to let the tsunami get in my way. She had been preparing for a summer performance when the wave came. The Hama Uta always brought fish into the nets. It brought prosperity. I used a basket as a prop and put fish into it. There was a special Kamaishi dance that went with the song. When I performed it, everyone was quiet. I'm the last person alive who knows the song. Ito-san takes my hand and tells me her most recent news. Someone found her obi in the rubble and returned it to her, though everything else in her house was lost. Where's the man who saved your life, I ask. I'd like to meet him. She smiles, stands, and says, let's go find him. She's about this tall and, 84, and but just could outrun me. Abe-san pulls the van to the front door, and despite his attempts to assist her, she jumps into the high front seat with a young woman's agility. Down the ruined streets we go, past the huge ship and its red hull, looping up past the restaurant where Ito-san performed for 75 years, and around again. Her window is open, and she waves at everyone like a queen. People run to the side of the van to greet her. You're looking wonderful, they say. She points to the remains of a large two-story structure on a corner. That's my house, she says excitedly, and doesn't seem to mind that it's in ruins. I was trying to get to the front door during the earthquake, but it was shaking so hard I couldn't stand up. That's when Hiroyuki, my friend who sells sake, came by. When he saw me crawling, he stopped, then he just reached down and pulled me onto his back and started running. He carried me all the way up the hill just as the tsunami water began coming in. He saved my life. Oh, she was heavy, he said when we meet him. I carried her up this hill over there, he says, pointing. We spent the night there. We watched our houses wash away. Hiroki-san gives me something in a paper bag, a lovely bottle of sake. You see, I'm still in business, even if I have no store. I make deliveries. If you like sake, please accept us. And thank you for coming from so far away to meet us, he says. Ito-san's eyes sparkle. She leans in close and whispers, would you like to hear something? I bow and nod yes. Out comes the shamisen from under a soft cloth. Hiroyuki sits on his heels attentively. As Ito-san tunes her instrument, he whispers, I love this song. It pulls at the heart. Slowly, Ito-san begins plucking the three strings. Her voice quavers at first, then grows stronger, and the words of the Hama Uta begin. Two gifts, the bottle of sake, and the hum of the cavernous room going quiet as it fills with the sound of Ito-san's sweet song. One of the things that happened. I had one contact in all of this, and that was through a friend who used to be at San Francisco Zen Center, and she had gone to monastery in Japan with a young Japanese woman, and this woman had gone to help her uncle take care of this country temple. Well, the temple was 6 miles up a river that during the tsunami, a wave intruded all the way up, wiping people up. Well, first, a whole elementary school, 75 young children, 10 out of 11 teachers were just wiped away, washed away. And then all the farmers and there were the little lumber yards along there, and many, many, many of them were killed because they were had no idea that the water would come all the way up the river. So the temple was in this strange situation. People began, the survivors began dragging the dead up to the temple. They didn't know what else to do with them, and they weren't going to just leave them there. And they were using wheelbarrows. They were carrying them over their shoulders. And the abbot, who was 84 and not really in good health, but a very lovely, gentle, elegant man, said, you know, at some point, first 75 people descended on the temple and you know, to take refuge. And then the dead started coming, and he said pretty soon this little tiny courtyard was just chock-a-block with dead people. And he said at one point, I leaned against the wall and looked out, and I said, I wasn't really trained to do this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do now. But of course, he and his young niece just started doing funeral services as best they could. And Fukan-san is his niece, and so I went there maybe four or five times, and this was one day when I went to visit her. Fukan-san makes tea in the corner of the temple. We sit on tatami. She says that when she arrived in early April, there were coffins everywhere. So many of them, I couldn't count, she said, but maybe 100 dead people outside around the big tree. Some coffins didn't have lids. It looked like a graveyard full of zombies. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say things like that, but I was so scared. The bodies had been taken from the river, and their wet clothes were in plastic bags. When I saw all this, she said, I began shaking. The situation was too awful. Some people saw neighbors' kids hanging in trees. Other children were discovered, buried in the mud, just a hand showing. People saw many things, and it's hard to erase those terrible sights from the mind. My uncle, the abbot, she said, looked exhausted. He was writing the names of the dead on the sacred sticks. His room was full of them. There had been people living here at the temple in the early weeks, but they were gone. From then on, it was just funeral after funeral. After I put my things away, I thought I'd better go out and see what had happened in the villages. I went by bicycle. The houses I had known when I visited as a child were either washed away or broken. I saw upside-down cars in a rice field and huge trees knocked down and a greenhouse broken to bits. People were getting whatever they could of their personal belongings, and volunteers were shoveling mud. I had only sandals on, and it was hard to make my way. The asphalt was broken, and deep mud covered everything. Finally, my bicycle came to a halt. I rode back, and soon I was conducting funerals. Young and robust, Fukan-san is slated to take over the duties of the abbot, who's in bad health, when he can no longer serve the Sangha. She leans in close and whispers, my mother wanted me to be a hairdresser. I have a beautician's license, she says, grinning. I know how to cut hair. I look at her shaved head and burst out laughing. That life wasn't for me, so I became a nun. More laughter. Was that your only other choice? I asked. More laughter. There's a long silence. Candlelight flickers across the photographed faces of tsunami victims. I ask how many funerals she's conducted. She says she can't remember. There have been so many. Hundreds died in the farming communities around here, and now we've merged with the Kanonchi community, and we have the ashes of 100 more. All afternoon, mourners file past. Two young mothers bring photographs of their dead children to place on the altar. They're very matter-of-fact about it. We finally got them framed, they say, smiling. We look at the faces of the children and nod. The women put the photographs on the altar under the urns of ash. We light sticks of incense. They bow to Fukan-san and leave. A family group comes in talking and laughing, paying one's respect to the departed is now routine. Another family, more solemn, approaches Fukan-san, the father, mother, and two children, and they prostrate themselves before her. She remains expressionless, waits for them to rise, and returns the bow. Others come and go while we sip tea. A few are crying. They hold hands tightly and small. A lone woman lays a bouquet of sunflowers wrapped in newspaper near the front doors, with the blossoms facing us. I thought earlier that I would want to talk to these people, but what would the conversation be? The steady procession says it all. They are grieving. Fukan-san shares in the pain. She said, "Some days I thought I didn't understand Buddhism well enough, but I learned two things. We have to behave as humans and feel the situations as they come before us. Every day is important. No regrets. This is all we have." I'm going to close with... So we drove around a lot in Abasan's van. He lived in a sort of shack way, way, way up in the mountains. Absolutely beautiful. The shack wasn't so beautiful, but the mountainside was beautiful. And it became this kind of, in a way, this coming and going was in itself a sort of river. And it was sort of a kind of meditation. We were always quiet. We didn't talk. We just went up and then we came back down. In between, we were bathing at the public baths with all the other workers down below in another ruined town. And I actually composed this chapter on my BlackBerry as we were driving. It's called On the Road Again. Abe-san slides into the seat of the van and turns the key. The engine starts. This is in December, so it's cold. And the heater comes on. We scrape ice from the windshield. He lets the van roll before putting it in gear, takes the twisting road to the top of the mountain, and careens down the other side. No traffic. The dead deer we saw, more than half eaten, its carcass, a kind of calendar of days. As soon as it's entirely consumed, he says, it's time to leave Japan. When I close my eyes, we fall upward. The shape of the road enters us, the apple orchard, baseball field, bamboo forest, its branches hanging down and sweeping the ground. A farmer by the side of the road is making charcoal to use as water purifier. Abe-san talks a litany of outrages at government corruption about when he will next distribute donated supplies. The mind is flung this way and that, the rope of days braided back into itself, the ends joined, a loop that keeps open the circle of living and dying, morning and evening, night and day. Nikki's sparkling youth and Abe-san's generosity, beautiful ruptures, openings that delight me in the midst of tragedy. Yet a fisherman we talked to said, now there's no happiness in our lives because of the radiation. We glide over frosted earth, over blunt-cut fields of harvested rice, sugi trees bending down to us as if in conversation, their short needles tiny, filigreed, whole forests of green lace. Where trunks have fallen sideways, we drive on heartwood, smooth, smooth, bumping across rice fields and water ditches. We pierce each small farm as we go, cutting through leafless persimmon trees hung with orange orbs. All those moons, Nikki says, lopped in half. We cross a river, our velocity splitting open the valley like a peach. Buckled roads fall to either side of the van, and smoke from debris piles fades into dusk, or is it morning? Lights from the vanquished town of Rikuzen Takata come on, as if from non-existent houses. A brief twinkling, then the illusion fades, the town's desolation cut, the two halves identical, their tidal monotonies and rubbish-glutted shores, all the pines but one pulled like teeth. We're falling, Forward now, not down. Open, away from what is broken. To slice is to heal. We enter the ocean, wrapped and wakeful, its rough grain cracking open. The van moving north and south at once, the wave falling on either side of the blade. Thank you. Questions? So much happened in those 3 months, it's, you know, hard to sum it up in half an hour. Yes?
You focused on the attitude of overcoming and not dwelling in sorrow. This was in the country where you were?
Yeah, totally rural.
In the city, was the philosophy more evaporated?
Well, the tsunami didn't, I mean, except for the Sendai Plain, the tsunami didn't really come into the, into.
But they knew big, people.
Yeah.
People
I don't know.
There. Did you go into the city?
Well, I was in Tokyo a few times, but, oh, louder? I'm sorry. Oh, yes, I forgot. Thank you. I was wondering what you were doing over there. I'm supposed to repeat the questions. The question was, where I focused on the attitudes of people out in the country, but did people in the city express this kind of unsentimental, sort of take it as it comes attitude? And I can't really say because they weren't really affected. And the time I spent in Tokyo, I was talking to nuclear activists, Greenpeace people who are working on working with fishermen to help with marine radiation measurements, etc. So I can't really answer your question. Yes?
Were you at all concerned about your exposure to radiation? And
the question is, was I concerned about my exposure to radiation? Well, one does think about it, but I'm old, and I called my doctor, and he said, well, by the time it gets to you, you know, you'll be dead anyway. So I was worried for Nikki, who's a young woman, and, you know, but she lives in Tokyo, even though we said, you know, you need to leave, and for a while, which she did. But, you know, we were, Sendai is 100 miles north of Fukushima Daiichi, so, and we went north from there, so, but, you know, the radiation is everywhere, and it's in all the food, and we were very careful about what we ate. No, absolutely no fish, no seaweed, and, you know, anything that's static in the water just absorbs radiation. So they said, the fishermen said, well, eat the migrating fish, but don't eat the ones that hang around all the time. I mean, you know, they have no choice. It's a country that lives on fish and rice. We ate only the previous year's rice. We bought vegetables that had been grown in Hokkaido. And so far, we're all fine. Yes?
Japan's been going through really tough economic times. How has that affected the government being able to help?
Yeah. I mean, the government, you know, I would say they're really stretched. I think, you know, in some situations, they've done a magnificent job. They made sure that all the evacuation centers were properly staffed. They built all these temporary housing things. They're buying land for everybody. People have to pay for the building of their own houses. They're giving fishermen something between 75 and 95% of the money to buy a used boat and to get back out in the ocean fishing again. They're helping rice farmers find places to rent or buy to start maybe not growing rice, but just to grow food. There have been, you know, some, of course, horrible corruptions and betrayals along the way. Of course, the whole thing with the radiation is, I mean, I would say that's the biggest economic plight. I think they can, they'll do okay with helping that population. There's probably about 300,000 refugees that they're helping. But it's the radiation situation, because now no food from Japan is can be shipped out of there. Nobody wants it. And so, you know, their whole, all their trade agreements are in peril. And in fact, now they've just made a deal with American ranchers to ship beef over there. They've sort of lifted the tariffs on that. So, you know, they're trying to work it, but I'm sure it's hard. And the yen is falling. And but, you know, but they're like, they're in better shape than Greece and Spain, I think. You know, they're pretty viable country. Yes?
I particularly love the Solus of Open Spaces, and I wonder if there are comparisons between the responses of the people in Umeda, Japan, to the harshness of what they experienced, and the responses of the people in New Wyoming, in, you know, again, a rural setting, sometimes facing some serious hardships as well.
Yeah. The question is, I'm sorry, I need you, Lisa. You have to help me. The question is, I wrote a book called The Solace of Open Spaces, and are there any correlations between the attitudes of Wyoming rural people and what and the attitudes of people in rural Japan, I think. Sort of summarizes it. You've got to make your questions easy to repeat. Well, you know, I think rural people everywhere in the world have a wonderful vitality and, you know, you think you can get me down, throw some more at me attitude. You know, they express it in different ways, but that's certainly what I experienced being a rancher in Wyoming. The worse things got, the better people became. And I mean, not in the sense of being macho, but of actually, you know, embracing the situation and seeing your way through it, because often it's a life and death situation or something close to it. And so you can't, there's no room to pretend or fool around. You have to really be on the spot and just do what needs to be done. So, of course, I saw that everywhere in Japan. And people, you know, their background's very different. They, you know, their whole aesthetic is sort of based on beauty framed by impermanence. A sense of perishability and of living on 8 islands that are so seismically active that to go for a day without an earthquake seems a little odd. You know, you see. While I was there, there were very strong earthquakes every single day, and if a few hours went without one, you would sort of think, you know, what's wrong? Something just seemed a little strange. But, you know, I think so. It was a situation where the landscape shaped consciousness. And I see that happening everywhere. I've traveled all over the Arctic and with subsistence Inuit hunters on dog sleds. And I saw the same, you know, really direct action, no matter what happened. And the worse it got, the better, the more precise, disciplined, prescient they were. They were just like knives cutting through. And of course, that's, you know, they expressed that. I think maybe in Japan they've expressed that way of living in their in all the forms of their arts in a way that nobody else, maybe anywhere in the world, has. And maybe that's what I find so extraordinary about the place. Yes?
I have a comment rather than a question, if that's okay. On the back, it says this book is Nature and Current Affairs. You were talking about how you couldn't sum it up in 30 minutes. I think they left out Lyric Essay and Meditation and Political Science and Religious Studies and everything else here, too. So I'm about halfway through it, and I'm just loving it. And so I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you. She said on the back of this book, it says it's under the class. I never even looked at that. Of Nature and, what was it?
Current
Affairs are my favorite subject in school. And was questioning the wisdom of those two things. But thank you very much. I think it's good if you can write a book that they don't know how to classify. Maybe it's not so great for bookstore owners where you have to. But then I say, well, just put them on in every section. Yes?
Did you interview any children?
I didn't. Nikki did. And I, as I said, you know, the times that I might have been able to do that, you know, in a way that was, you know, respectful, was at this temple, you know, to interview someone in the Sangha. And the day I was really going to do it was the day that I read about when I sat with Fukan-san. I'm sorry, he asked, did I interview any children? And I'm saying, no, I didn't, because that was the day when people were just filing through, and their grief was so profound, as the old Chinese poem said. It really says about passion so deep it seems like none. But in a way, the grief was so deep it seemed like none, in the sense that there was no way to enter it, and to it just didn't seem right. But I heard stories about children. A great story that Masumi's father told me was two young cousins, they were little boys, like six or something, were riding in the back of the car with one of the kids' parents. The car went over the bridge when the tsunami wave came. The parents were drowned. The two children were separated, but you know, they were holding hands, but the wave, you know, threw them apart. They both lived. The one whose parents were still alive was returned home, but the one whose parents had died in that car was just sent to an evacuation center, and people were looking after him. Months later, the cousin with the live parents went looking for his little cousin and found him and took him home to live with them forevermore, which is a lovely story. Well, thanks very much, Duncan. What?
Just one last thing I wanted to say on that note that you said was the two fishermen, that he didn't know what had happened to his house or the wife or the mother and so on. And then in the end, with the same perseverance and looking, they found him. The two fishermen, the man and the son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
stories like that, the perseverance.
Yeah, Duncan said there was a father and son fishing team who, after they got back in, they went looking for their family and found them. I mean, they, you know, trudging through debris and broken, you know, you can't, I mean, the debris in some of these towns was, you know, a story high. You'd drive down a road, and the debris was a wall that was as high as a building. And it was sort of, well, it was amazing. So just to get around anywhere was a feat. And then, you know, to be afraid of what you found. Even in December, There were still men, old men in little tiny rowboats rowing around through sort of swamps and stuff looking for, you know, poking their oars, looking for bodies. There's still, well, I mean, you know, we didn't really get all the numbers, but more than 28,000 people were killed. And there's still thousands missing. And the most valiant woman, a young woman who was so angry that there weren't enough police to go around, you know, ended up renting a backhoe. She had just had a baby, so she had her baby on her side, was in this backhoe by herself, digging up along that riverbank, helping people looking for missing people so they could give them proper burials. And the last I heard, she was still at it. She said, "I'm not going to stop until everybody is found." So that's an amazing spirit. Thank you very much for coming. And thank you, Tattered Cover, for having me.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.